From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, local reaction to President Trump's State of the Union speech, including his call for unity.
I look for unity. I really do. I don't feel like unity is a muscle that this president has.
Also today, a legal victory in a long campaign for transparency and accountability in the federal courts.
This information belongs to the public so that the public can make independent judgments about how the system is working.
And choreographer Mark Morris on his new dance show based on the music of the Beatles and the challenge of talking about it on the radio. Can you describe the dancing in this work?
Nope. I won't. I don't.
You
can't.
Don't.
Because not on the radio.
The sound of one man dancing coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with reaction to President Trump's State of the Union address. His speech last night rocked and rolled between calls for bipartisan unity and his insistence that he'll build the wall on the southern border himself if a divided Congress refuses to fund it. The speech had been postponed because of last month's government shutdown, and it came as another potential shutdown looms if lawmakers can't work out a deal on border security. We're joined now from Washington by Congressman Seth Moulton. He's a Democrat who represents the Massachusetts 6th District. And Congressman Moulton, always good to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be back, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
Sure. I'd love to start just by asking you in general, what was the major headline that you took away from the president's speech last night?
Well, the big headline was a lot of talk, and it's not backed up by any action in his administration. He talked a big game about bipartisanship, about coming together to solve many of the big challenges that our country faces. But of course, the story from day one of his administration, and indeed even from his campaign, is not one of working together. It's one of division. And it's a division not just in Washington between Democrats and Republicans, but literally sowing division across the country. This has been the most divisive administration in a very long time, certainly in my lifetime.
But Congressman, there he was talking to a divided Congress for the first time, and he did use some pretty stirring rhetoric, saying things like, together we can break decades of political stalemate, we can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions, forge new solutions, and so on and so forth. Should Democrats take him at his word and give him a chance to make good on those words?
Why would we take him at his word when he literally lies every day? We've never been able to take him at his word. And that's what's so sad about this presidency, is that you simply cannot trust the commander-in-chief. I'll tell you, being there, there were moments when it was almost like being at a comedy show. Like I felt like I was on the set of Saturday Night Live, because what he was saying was so hypocritical that it was almost comical. It was so unbelievable that it was just ridiculous.
Well, what are you referring
and
to in particular?
Sadly, every time he talked about bipartisanship, every mm-hmm. time he talked about actually coming together and cooperating, every time he talked about, you know, rising above the political challenges of the day, when, of course, that's not what he does. That's not what he does any day. And so I wanted to have a commander-in-chief that even if I disagreed with, I could trust. You know, I served under commander-in-chief George W. Bush. I didn't vote for him twice. I didn't agree with his war. I was openly critical of it. But as a United States Marine, I never imagined that George W. Bush would be someone that I fundamentally couldn't trust, that someone that might, you know, work with foreign powers, that would precipitously take our troops out of Syria because of a conversation with Turkey. Turkey's president, for in all intents and purposes, is an adversary, someone who wouldn't be willing to release the transcripts of his discussions with a foreign adversary like Russia. I mean, this is a commander-in-chief that we just can't trust, and that's a feeling felt, frankly, on both sides of the aisle.
Congressman, I want to ask you about this continuing disagreement that he's having with Democrats about the southern border wall. He reiterated his commitment, notwithstanding his call for unity. He reiterated his commitment to building that border wall last night. Here's a little bit of what he said.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
Congressman, what do you make of that, and where this effort to kind of bridge this impasse stands right now? I know I know Congress is trying to come up with a solution on border funding. The president is continuing to insist on this issue of the wall, which he ran on. Where is this going to go with a possible shutdown looming again Friday the 15th?
Well, you've highlighted one of the many ways that the president is untruthful and divisive, because he accuses Democrats of being for open borders, of being opposed to border security. And yet, as he said in his statement, Democrats and Republicans have both voted for border security in the past. But what we want is real border security. We don't want some 5th century BC wall. We want border security that will actually work. Are drugs coming into this country a problem? Yes, but they're coming through ports of entry, not through the open desert. There's mountains of evidence that prove that. And so that's why Democrats have supported border security in the form of better technology, better tech detection devices, and more customs and border enforcement agents. That's the kind of border security that we actually need. Now, there's a bipartisan group of colleagues who are working to come up with this kind of compromise, to come up with the kind of compromise, or at least the first step towards the true immigration reform that we need, that not only includes better border security, but a pathway to citizenship for those who are here, who are parts of our community and essential to our economy, for tackling issues like the immigration of students who come on visas. It's such a big issue in Massachusetts, where we educate a lot of foreign nationals, but then have a program that sends them back home.
But Congressman, I get all that, but
get here and go overseas.
Yeah, and
that's the kind of compromise that we need, and our colleagues are working on it. But to get to your point, Anthony, the question is whether the president will accept it.
Right.
I just don't know.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that he's not going to accept it if it doesn't contain any money for the wall. And it seems like if you've got a Speaker of the House calling the wall immoral and just saying there's not going to be money for the wall, why not just give him something, give him some funding for a physical barrier, and then talk about all the rest of the stuff that you just mentioned? I mean,
that's a fair question. I think there are two points. One, let's talk about the question is, first of all, does the president actually want border security, or does he just want to make a political point by being able to point to a wall that's a waste of money and won't work? And by the way, that he promised Mexico would pay for. So that's the first question. If he actually wants real border security, because that's the problem at hand, then we'll come to the table with that. The second question is whether he will actually agree to a deal on immigration reform like we're putting forward at the end of the day, because a year ago we had another government shutdown and he made a deal on Dreamers, on giving them a pathway to citizenship, something that's supported by the vast majority of Americans, Democrats and Republicans alike. And then 2 days later, he changed his mind and he proved himself again a totally untrustworthy partner. And so the deal completely fell apart and the government shut down. So those are the two questions. Will he accept real border security, even if it's not the political wall that he wants? And will he actually live up to the terms of a deal that's negotiated with him?
So what do you think? This is literally in the 5 or 10 seconds that we have left here, Congressman. I don't know if you're a betting man, but what do you bet? Is there going to be another government shutdown on Friday, or is this deal going to get done?
I've never done well in Vegas, Anthony. You know, so much of this depends on the whims of the president, and he's just an erratic man who's impossible to predict, and that's not a healthy thing for our government. So the risk of a shutdown is real, but we've got to make sure it doesn't happen again.
All right. Well, that's Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents the 6th District. Congressman Moulton, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, and let's stick with this story and get a little more reaction from the president's speech, including from one of his supporters. Joining us here in the studio is Massachusetts Republican State Chairman, State Committee member, Tom Mountain of Newton. Tom, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure.
Also joining us on the line from Worcester is Democratic strategist and president of the Liberty Square Group, Scott Fersen. Scott, welcome back to you. It's good to have you back on Radio Boston as well.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we should mention, by the way, Scott, that you were a senior advisor to Seth Moulton during the 2014 campaign. We were just talking to the congressman, so I just wanted to put that out there. But Tom Mountain, since we heard Seth Moulton kind of offer pretty much an unapologetic stream of criticism of the president, let me start with how you felt the president did last night and what you liked about what he said.
Well, Seth Moulton is really living in an alternative Democrat universe. Even the liberal CBS and CNN polls offer overwhelming support of the president's speech last night, 76% CBS and 59% CNN. So the public greatly approved of his speech. This speech was absolutely magnificent, probably the best speech I've heard since Ronald Reagan's speech.
What did you like about it? I mean, what was magnificent about it?
It was optimistic. It was buoyant. It had a specific plan for the future. It was witty. He was charming. But above all, it was based on fact and factual optimism. By factual optimism, I mean what he has accomplished and what he will accomplish. We're now at a stretch where the federal government has created 5.3 million jobs under Donald Trump. 600,000 manufacturing jobs have come back to the country, despite what his predecessor Barack Obama said. Black unemployment is at an all-time low, as is Hispanic unemployment. We're at the lowest unemployment rates in 50 years. ISIS has been defeated. Iran has been neutralized. We're negotiating with North Korea.
So, Tom Mountain, I mean, you've put a lot of stuff on the table, and we don't have a chance and an opportunity in this context to go through every one of those things. But those are certainly Donald Trump's talking points. And as you know, there's a lot of pushback.
But they're reality.
Some of them are reality and some of them are debatable. I mean, let's talk about ISIS. We know that ISIS isn't completely defeated. His own generals have pointed that out for one example. But I get your point, and I understand your enthusiasm and your support for him. But what about this conversation about the wall? Because he's calling for unity. He's facing a Democratic Congress right now. Clearly, the Democrats aren't going to give him that money for the wall. So is this really a realistic call for unity on the one hand, but to be insisting that no matter what, we're going to get this wall?
Yes, the wall is going to be built, and Donald Trump realizes that, and he's not politicking at this point. Mm. He is certainly sincere enough to realize and to make the American people realize that we need the southern wall in order to secure our borders. Every country needs to secure its borders. This southern border is not secured. The wall will be built. If he has to make the end around Congress, then it will be built. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck
Schumer. You're talking about declaring a national emergency?
Yes, and I hope he does.
Way.
And I think that he's holding out just to let the American public really see what the Democrats are all about. They're obstructionists. They don't care about border security. They don't care. All they care about is having open borders on the southern border. And he will let that play out as long as it can and will declare a national emergency, which he can based on the 1976 law passed by a Democratic Congress, I might add. The Army Corps of Engineers will move into high gear, and the wall will start to be built, and it will be built, and it will prevent. And walls work. They've worked around the world. They work in Israel very well, and it will prevent illegal immigration from coming into this country. Then we can deal with the DACA and issue in the illegals here.
All right, Scott, first I want to bring you in on this conversation. What was your takeaway from last night's speech? And start anywhere you want, but just as a bit of sort of political theater, how do you think the president did?
Well, it did. I mean, it's the State of the Union is the height of political theater for anybody, whether you're a Democrat or Republican there. So, and Donald Trump certainly took full advantage of it, I think, to a full 86 minutes or something of high theater. To me, it sort of broke down into three parts of, a State of the Union in three acts. The first, I thought, was really very well done. You can quibble on whether who gets credit for the economic strength of the United States, and there's certainly a lot to go around. But basically, if you're president of the United States, you get to own that, I think. And I thought the first 20 minutes was very strong in terms of talking about the state of the union, if you will, based on the economy and all of the economic indicators that are there. And the incumbent president gets to take credit for those things, whether he's responsible for all of them or not. And then the second part, I thought, took quite a dark turn. And I'm sure appealed to some people, but to me, it seemed like a 20 minutes of a xenophobic screed that was, to me, quite disturbing and overblown to the situation that we face on the southern border. I mean, if I just listened to that without understanding the immigration policy and the things that were actually happening on the southern border, I barricaded myself in my basement with my family.
So, Scott Ferson, hold that thought, because I want to actually play a little bit from last night. Here's Donald Trump talking about the situation on the southern border.
Large, organized caravans are on the march to the United States. I have ordered another 3,750 troops to our southern border to prepare for this tremendous onslaught.
Tremendous onslaught. Scott Ferson, that's the kind of dark view that you're talking about.
Yeah, it almost sounded like War of the Worlds. You know, it's, you know, I think if there's a compromise here. There's a compromise. And frankly, if I were a Democratic legislator, I'd be comfortable giving the president some money for a border wall, or as he mentioned last night, I believe he called it a see-through steel border wall, which I'm not sure I quite got. But with whatever it might look like, we waste money on lots of things. If we could couple it with DACA, and it seems pretty reasonable that coupling DACA with some funding and a win for the president on his border wall would be a reasonable compromise.
What do you think, Tom?
Actually,
go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, is xenophobic and the other dour paranoid euphemisms that the Democrats spew towards the president. We're used to it. 72% of the American public approved of Donald Trump's direction towards building a wall and dealing with immigration head on.
Well, that's not true.
Where the CBS poll. The CBS poll last night. And
that's different from policy. The reaction to the speech is different from what people believe about policy.
What we're talking about is protecting our southern border, sealing the border, letting in those legal immigrants rather than illegals, stopping them before they come here. Nations have to protect their borders. If their borders are threatened, they have to take drastic action to protect the borders. Dwight Eisenhower did it in the 50s. Ronald Reagan tried to do it in the 80s but was betrayed by the Democrats. And Donald Trump will settle the issue once and for all. And it has nothing to do with xenophobia. It has everything to do with protecting the nation that is the United States from illegal immigrants.
But
we
Tom,
want
let me
legal
just,
immigrants.
Okay, and I take that point. Two things. I just do want to correct you. The CBS poll last night refers to the approval of the State of the Union speech as a whole. 76% of Americans approved of that, according to CBS. But the majority of Americans are against the wall, and a number of polls have shown that. But I want to talk to you about
That's debatable, Anthony, but I won't.
Okay.
Let's not
split hairs over that right now. Scott Ferson put a really interesting idea, and I actually tried to bring that up with Seth Moulton a while ago, and that is this idea of a compromise. If the Democrats said to Donald Trump, okay, here's maybe, I don't know, $2.5 billion, $3 billion on your wall, can we talk about all these other issues, about DACA, about a legal path for citizenship for folks who have been here living in the dark for a long time? Would that be something
of
that...
Of course. Donald Trump, the president, is open for compromise, but the wall needs to be built. The borders need to be secure. Then we can deal with the DACA people. Then we can deal with the illegals in the country. But the border needs to be secured first before hundreds of thousands more come into this country
So I'm not sure if that was an affirmative response to the question that I asked, because the problem with that the president faces among his supporters is that if he appears to give in at all on this issue, then they turn against him.
We're primarily concerned with building the wall. Everything else can come afterwards, negotiable, but building the wall, that is the key element to his presidency for the United States right now. It must be done, and it will be done with or without the Democrat Congress.
That's not a compromise if you do yours first and then get to what the Democrats get. That's not compromise.
Well, it is compromise, because we're willing to talk about these issues after we secure our border. We have to secure our border first.
I'm for democracy unless I get my way, and then I'm going to do it. That's not compromise.
No, the Democrats control Congress, the Republicans control the administration, and we'll work out the details after the wall is built. The Democrats, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, being in Congress for 3 decades, they had 3 decades to deal with this issue. They failed to do so. Now we have to deal with this issue before it's too late, and we're tired of it. We're tired of waiting.
But Tom Mountain, on the other hand, President Trump had 2 years of Republican control of Congress and couldn't get this done.
That's true.
So isn't it sort of logical, even for Trump supporters, to accept the proposition that now he's dealing with divided government, he's going to have to change his position a little bit if he wants to get something done? He doesn't control Congress anymore.
Well, he is changing his position, and the position is still build the wall. We'll deal with the illegals that are in this country afterwards. That's a reasonable
position. I don't know how that changes his
position.
Scott Ferson, we're running out of time, but I'm going to give the last word to you. Where do you think this debate goes? And are you optimistic that the government we're going to avoid a second government shutdown come Friday the 15th?
No, I'm not. I'm not optimistic. I mean, I haven't heard anything on. In this little discussion that tells me that there's that the president is willing to compromise on anything. And in fact, it's, I think it's find it quite disturbing that if it's sort of like I'm for democracy, but if I don't get my way, I'm going to do it on my own by executive order, I find quite chilling as well. So there is a compromise here,
Jimmy
but
Carter
it has to couple
that,
DACA with some funding for the wall, it seems to me.
All right, we're going to leave it there. I know, Tom Mountain, I know that this is a debate that's heated and it'll go on, and we're going to have you back as this conversation continues. Thank you for
coming in.
I appreciate
pleasure.
It. Tom Mountain, Massachusetts Republican State Committee member from Newton, and Scott Ferson, Democratic strategist, president of the Liberty Square Group. Scott Ferson, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, how to balance the public's right to know with a judge's desire to protect the identity of jurors. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And now this question, how do we uphold transparency and accountability in the federal court system? In short, the public's right to know with a judge's desire to protect the identity of jurors when they might be in danger. It's an important question because sometimes, like in a terrorism trial, jurors might be in danger if their identities, their addresses were made public. This question was at the heart of a decision last month by the First Circuit Court of Appeals. The court ruled that in federal trials, jurors' names and addresses must be released in a timely manner after the verdict. Now, full disclosure here, WBUR was front and center in this case. Our lawyers, BU lawyers that is, filed multiple motions requesting the release of jury lists during a number of high-profile cases, including a terrorism case and another case about responsibility for a deadly meningitis outbreak. WBUR special correspondent David Boeri led our efforts, and he joins us now in the studio. David, it's great to see you back.
Great to see you,
Anthony.
Studio.
Thank you for coming in. Also with us in our studio is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Nancy, always good to have you.
Good to be here.
So, listeners, if you have questions about this, we'd love to get you in on the conversation. Do you think releasing the names and addresses of jurors is vital for transparency in our judicial process? You're going to hear a lot of reasons why it is. If you served on a jury, would you want your information out there, or are you concerned about privacy, about safety? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, David, let me start with you with this most basic question. For a lot of folks out there, it might not be obvious to them, but why is it important that a journalist like you, journalists like us, should have access to members of a jury after a trial?
To find out what influenced the jurors in reaching their verdicts. This is an important thing. The courts have always recognized it's important that we, in a democracy, criminal trial should not, as a rule, be tried by anonymous witnesses. So, excuse me, by anonymous persons, that we don't have secret trials. The trial, what happens, the arguments made in court are publicized. And so there's a need to talk to the jurors afterwards to find out how they were influenced. And let me tell you, over the course of several years covering the federal court here, I talked to one of the Tsarnaev jurors before the list was released. And what was it? Well, he told us that as far as he was concerned, the critical information was that Zhahar Tsarnaev standing beside a bag for 4.5 minutes. That was the critical decision as far as he was concerned, the critical piece of information. In the Top Chef case, which you recall involved union activity against the show Top Chef, we talked to the jurors there. after we got the list, their names, we tracked them down. They told us that they were overwhelmingly in favor of acquittal, which raises the question of whether that charge by the U.S. Attorney's Office was overzealous, whether it should have ever been filed in the first place. There's lots of information you can get from jurors.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a couple of cases there. What cases in particular led you to pursue these lists and eventually to take this case to court?
So over the course of time, I recognized that, in fact, a number of federal judges were not following what's been the ruling precedent in this district since 1990, which is that the proceedings are presumed to be public and that jurors' names shall be released after the verdict. And so I recognized that we weren't getting the list, or we were getting the names but not the addresses. The addresses turn out to be critical to identifying people. So there were two in particular that broke in the same year. One involved the New England Compounding Center case, and the other one involved a terrorist, a so-called homegrown terrorist, David Wright, in a separate trial. We sought the jury list in both those cases. In the New England Compounding Center case, which, as you know, has a major interest nationally because over 76 deaths had resulted from contaminated samples, that are, right. Contaminated medicines that had gone out from Framingham. So we applied for that, we filed a motion for that list. The judge would not grant us the names and the addresses, which were critical to finding the jurors. He wouldn't do it.
Right. I want to come back to how important that is. But Nancy Gertner, Judge Gertner, I'd love to ask you about this, your perspective as a judge. Could you talk a little bit about this precedent? How soon after a verdict is a jury list expected to be released? And how much information is expected to be released with that list?
The jury list includes the names and addresses of jurors.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be released in a timely fashion. The court doesn't necessarily define it. But the rule since 1990, affirmed over and over again by the First Circuit, by the plan for selection in the district, was that jury lists become public information after the trial and shall be released unless a court finds that the interests of justice require that it doesn't. Mm. And what that means is, typically it means that law developed in mob cases where there were credible threats of jury tampering and against the jurors. So the presumption is disclosure unless you can say that there is a threat of harm involved. After the trial is over, things change, right? There's no concern about, there's no Sixth Amendment concern, jury trial right concern, that the pool will be, that the somehow the trial will be tainted by publicity. The trial is over. There's been a conviction. So that slides away. There is a concern that, you know, wonderful reporters like David will be dogging jurors to disclose secret jury deliberations. That is a concern. There's no question about it. But we have a First Amendment. There are lots of things that people want to keep secret. But the First Amendment trumps those
and Anthony,
things.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
In our cases.
Are you going to disagree with me, David?
No, actually, I'm not. But I'm going to point out that in those cases that we were involved with, there were no findings made by the judges that there was a credible threat to the jury or to the judicial process. Instead, what happened in our cases was that the judges raised the threat of the internet, something that was new, that wasn't there in 1990, but they now talked about the invasion of privacy that it would be involved because those names would be out there, the addresses would be out there.
I see.
And so there was a projection, a generalized threat, a projection of a parade of horribles that would happen, that we would suffer if, in fact, the list were given to us. So it stirs.
And a parade of horribles for the jury
the
that
jury.
You would contact and
That's
perhaps
right.
do a story about, and then his or her
exactly.
name would be catapulted around
right.
the internet.
Right, but just because the definition of public has changed
yeah.
doesn't mean we cease to make things public. And essentially what the court was doing was saying it didn't want the jurors to be discomfited. We didn't want them to be annoyed. That's not the finding. The issue is serious threat to them. I might add, it's a very interesting conceptual problem. If you look at jurors as public decision makers, and that's what they are, then they, as part of a public proceeding, they may be annoyed by the disclosure of the lists. The jury service is certainly not fun, but they are. That's part of their public
because
obligation.
Jurors are largely decision makers. They are in the public sphere. They're seen as that. They are citizen soldiers, citizens, but sometimes soldiers called upon for a sacred duty here. And it's interesting. Let me read one of the from one of the orders by the judge denying us. This is Judge William Young, who presided over a terrorist trial involving David Wright, who had been convicted of plotting to kill Americans. We ask for the list. He writes back, and he's known for his bombastic pen. Routed and in retreat, their territorial aspirations today, but a bitter memory among blackened ruins, ISIS nonetheless remains a viciously dangerous yet shifting and shadowy group of depraved international terrorists. He then says, this court will provide no aid and comfort for ISIS propaganda. He's talking about David Bory seeking the jury list, and then says, therefore, even though there is no credible threat against anyone involved in this prosecution, I've checked, he writes. I will not follow my usual practice and reveal the names and home addresses of the jurors now that the case is over. So there you have it. He had made no finding, no finding of any credible threat. And Stearns did the same thing in denying, Judge Stearns, in denying us that list, when in fact we were talking about a pharmacist, Al Capone.
But wait a minute. Let me just stick with Judge. It's Judge Young, right?
Right.
Judge Young's point there isn't the point that the sort of dreadful potential and possibility of an ISIS terrorist agent could actually befall on one of these jurors. Isn't that a sort of reasonable and responsible way to think about
it? It is a possibility. And how do we measure possibilities? Let's look at the statistics.
Right.
There's never been a known retaliation against a juror after a verdict, whose name was reserved after
not
verdict.
Only that, if one can withhold names based on speculation of, you know, what's going on in Syria, then we've closed the proceedings. There's a risk, I suppose, but unless it's a credible risk, unless there's some issue with respect to it, then this is a public proceeding and these are public actors.
We've got a couple of interesting questions on the line. Listeners, if you want to join this conversation, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about releasing the names and addresses of jurors and how it's vital for transparency in our judicial process. A recent court case upheld that principle. What do you think? Let's go to John, who's calling from Roslindale. Go ahead, John. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, fascinating discussion, and it's a very difficult balancing act. I've been to law school, I've worked in legal research and in Chicago, and the gangs in Chicago are similar to some of the threatening patterns that you've discussed already, and I think there might be a happy medium where the jurors can be, even maybe mandated by law, accessible to certain journalists after the trial for a period of time as part of the jury service even, and that way valuable work like David Boies and others can be done without necessarily disclosing the names of these people, because I know that I've served as a juror. I've also served as a witness in a murder trial, and it can be intimidating. I mean, my situation where I served was nothing compared to, let's say, some gangland situations in South Chicago, which I think would be extremely dangerous.
John, I got it. If you put an interesting idea on the table, John, I really appreciate the call. What do you think? Judge Gert, let me come to you first. What do you think about the kind of compromise that John was suggesting there and the real expression of concerns about privacy there?
Well, two things. One is the question of making jurors available, what, to journalists that we certify? How does that jibe with the First Amendment in a social media age? That's number one. And number two, we've had 200 years of jury trials in this country. And if in any case there is a credible threat, a judge makes findings that there's a credible threat. It's not speculation. It's not, boy, this is a difficult case. It's a credible threat is the standard. And that's the only basis under which, you know, you close the First Amendment door. So I think it can't be these are bad cases and these are bad defendants. It has to be more than that, and we can live with that standard.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it's important to note that Al Capone was tried and convicted by jurors who were not anonymous. Their names were out there. So you have the statistical record, but I'd also suggest, and I appreciate the comments of the caller, I'd also suggest, though, that that without the names of the jurors being provided, then you have anonymous people at secret trials, essentially. And one has to wonder if somebody who knows his name will never be revealed will act differently in convicting somebody or sending someone, giving someone the death penalty, as to not.
Interesting. I want to bring in another voice. Jeffrey Pyle is an attorney with Prince Lobel Tye who represented WBUR in this case. And Jeffrey Pyle, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
So what is the latest on this case? It's not completely settled yet, is it?
No, the First Circuit has decided to give Judge Stearns an opportunity to meet the high standard that Judge Gertner just told your listeners about, a threat to the judicial system itself. The First Circuit has remanded the case to the district court to determine whether there is a sufficient justification for withholding the home addresses of the jurors in this case. We argued at the First Circuit level and at the district court level that this is a case about a pharmacist who ran a dirty lab that resulted in a nationwide meningitis outbreak. This isn't the kind of rare circumstance where a court could find that there was some threat to the judicial system from withholding addresses.
Yeah.
But I want to also point out another benefit to these to releasing Jerry List, and that relates to a different WBUR reporter named Bruce Gellerman. Bruce tracked down a juror from the murder trial of a young African American man in Massachusetts in 1986, and that juror told Bruce Gellerman that two jurors had mentioned to her that they assumed that the defendant in that case, a guy named Darrell Diamond Jones, was guilty because he was black.
You know, I'm going to just stop you right there because we actually have a little bit of tape from Bruce Gellerman's reporting on this case, on the conviction of Darrell Jones, who, as you pointed out, spent 32 years in prison for a murder he claims he never did. Let's just listen to this.
The first day of deliberation, there was two men. They were taking like a poll of the jury, you know, and I said not guilty. And these two fellas said guilty, guilty. I said, is it because he's black? And they said, yes. How do you like that?
So that was the juror, Eleanor Urbati, who Bruce Gellerman contacted. So Jeff Pyle, a good example of the importance of releasing these names and ways to contact the jurors.
Well, exactly. And it shows the prescience of the First Circuit decision in 1990 that held that these jury lists have to be made public because the court held and observed that there are many ways in which access to jurors can root out injustice, expose misconceptions among jurors, and otherwise serve the interests of justice. This isn't about prying into individual jurors' lives. This is about making sure that our judicial system works and produces just outcomes.
So let me just ask one sort of pushback question. I could imagine a potential juror saying, you know, I don't know if I feel comfortable giving an objective, honest response if I know you're going to release my name when this is all over, because some folks that maybe I don't want to deal with are going to come after me. What do you think? I mean, I'm going to put that question to anyone.
Right. I mean, there's a tension here. There's no question about it. We believe in, on the one hand, secret jury deliberations. We tell jurors, I told jurors, that, you know, the press may get in touch with you. We would prefer that you don't talk about the deliberations because they're sort of the reverse of what David said, which is you want people to be free to vote their conscience without feeling recrimination in their neighborhood, on the one hand. But we also don't tell jurors, you may not speak to the press. That tension between we would prefer that the deliberations are secret so as to free them up doesn't mean that you shut the door to the First Amendment. That's the tension here. And frankly, usually, I mean, the juror who comes forward, as in Bruce's case, is a juror who's suffering over something.
Yeah.
Now that was what?
Last point to you,
years.
David, because I know we've got like 15 seconds left, but I want to give you the last word. Go ahead.
It is all about accountability, that we need openness and accountability. And in this case, the Court of Appeals ruled that it is that nothing about the new internet age changes the fact that there's a need for accountability and transparency in our system of justice.
David Boeri, WBUR special correspondent, thanks for coming in. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
All the great work you do. Nancy Gertner, WBUR legal analyst and former federal judge, thank you. It's always great to have you.
Thank you.
And Jeffrey Pyle, attorney with Prince Lobel Tye, who represented WBUR in this case. Jeffrey, thank you for your time today, and thank you for your work, important work on this case. We're very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, choreographer Mark Morris pays tribute to the Beatles. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Mark Morris has been called the most influential choreographer alive. He started his modern dance company, the Mark Morris Dance Group, in 1980 and has choreographed over 130 works. He also has a reputation as being devoted to music, which has always set his company apart. So 2 years ago, he turned his attention to some of the most popular music of all time by the Beatles. The show Pepperland is Mark Morris's tribute to what some call the most original, perhaps the greatest rock album ever made, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. Pepperland is coming to Boston this weekend to the Box Center Schubert Theater, and Mark Morris joins us now from New York. Mark Morris, great to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's really good to talk to you. So, Pepperland was commissioned to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's. It was first staged in Liverpool, where the Beatles got their start. Tell me what inspired you to take on this project.
A gentleman I know, Sean Doran, who's wonderful at throwing festivals, did this one a couple years ago now for the 50th anniversary of the album, and asked me, an American choreographer, if I would participate. So the point of the festival, and it pretty much happened, was that different artists in different media would take on one of the tracks from the album. So I chose, with my composer and arranger, Ethan Iverson, the great jazz pianist, six of the songs from the album. And I just thought, since I hadn't listened to the Beatles for decades, I was surprised that when I listened to it, I found it to be so engaging and so surprising and good.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was 11 when it came out, and it was...
Yeah, me too, I think. Something like that.
Something like that. And it was huge. It was probably the greatest sort of musical moment in my young life at that point. Were you a super fan at that point? I mean, did the Beatles, like, blow you away at that age?
I don't know. If you're, like, 10, 11, you either are obsessed with something or you've never heard about it before. Right. So, yeah, I mean, my sisters were thrilled, and I thought they were really sexy, and... I mean, the Beatles, not my sisters. And, of course, the fact that thrilled me, and still does, you know, they were dipping into a lot of topics, being young and rich and, you know, in a studio with whatever they wanted. So the dabbling in Indian music and mysticism and vaudeville, you know, music hall and little bits of a lot of different things.
Right.
You know, which was, it's wonderful. And that's what keeps it interesting and sort of fresh today, I think.
Mark Morris, just to get us in the mood, I want to play some original Beatles music from Sgt. Pepper's and then hear some of the music from Pepperland, which is really interesting. It's different. So here's one of the signature songs from Sgt. Pepper, A Little Bit of a Day in the Life.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grave. I saw the photograph.
So, Mark, when you went to hear this music 50 years later, what did you hear when you revisited it?
What I got was, everybody who knows an album from the days of there being albums knows exactly how long the gaps are between tracks and what key and time the next number is in, and that doesn't go away. And I also remember it being longer than it was. You know, that final chord, which you think is an hour long at the end of the album, isn't. And so, you know, and the songs that I thought I loved turned out to be the ones I didn't love, and there's a certain self-similarity between some of the numbers. When Ethan and I chose what music to treat for this, you know, it's like, well, it's either this, this, or this. They're all kind of the same you know, circusy kind of thing, you know, or the sort of lovesick kind of thing, or the sort of bluesy thing.
Right.
So, you know, it was a big variety on the album, but it all happens really fast, and they actually refer to each other. So that sort of continuity of stylistic continuity was really, really interesting and sort of clever and sophisticated for people who are that young.
So I want to listen to some of the music now. As you mentioned, you worked with composer Ethan Iverson to create the music for Pepperland. And it's new music. It's different. It's inspired by Sgt. Pepper's, but it's different. So here's an excerpt from a piece you call Wilbur Scoville. So, Mark, I love the sound of that, but it's not the Beatles. Can you talk about your thinking behind the music and
well, of course it's not the Beatles. Yeah. The Beatles are the Beatles.
Right.
And they're done. They've been done for decades.
Right. So I'm just interested in the connection, you know, the connection. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly not doing a tribute or a nostalgic anything, because that's of no interest to me at all. Well, what you played, and it's called... Scofield, because that's who invented the rating, the scale for hotness in peppers. Mm-hmm. So that's the tie to that. Peppers, Scoville, hotness, plus, of course, all of the Delta blues that the Beatles were listening to. That was a very, very big influence on every single person who's ever dealt with the fundamentals of rock,
yeah.
You know, which is, of course, comes from the blues. So that's that. That refers to it. And also, you know, because the music that Ethan composed is to link the other passages, which are arrangements of the tunes on the album, even though they're very, very varied. You know, they're all different from the original and from themselves. So it's a musical trip that is obviously... derived from the Beatles and is in huge respect for that music, but it's a very, very different sound and a whole different sort of music world.
Hmm.
It's fabulous.
I want to ask you about the dance as well. I got to look at this particular number on YouTube. I got to say, I'd love to see this on the stage. It evokes the time of Sgt. Pepper's. Your dancers are dressed in sort of the bright colors of late 1960s mod fashion. But mm-hmm. Can you describe sort of the dancing in this work?
Nope. I won't. I don't.
You
can't.
Don't.
Because not on the radio. Uh-uh.
I know. Radio is sometimes a limited medium.
No, but, you come see the show. That's how you do it.
But we're talking to the great Mark Morris. We'd love it if you could say some words about your dance, about the dancing.
My dancers are great. I'm a really good choreographer. I do a lot of research and homework and study and thinking. And this piece shows all of that. It's a big variety of dancing. It's about an hour long, and it's very tender and beautiful and surprising. I can tell you that.
Thanks for that. I appreciate it. was there at all a challenge about approaching this material in the sense that so many people have, you know, a fixed idea, a love, a passion for this album? I'm just wondering if you had to deal with that or how you thought about that.
We had to think about getting the rights to perform it in public. That's what was the biggest deal. Hmm. But as far as what people expect and what they receive, I hope no one has any idea what to expect and is delighted with whatever they receive. So as I've said, this terrible sort of slogan I made up to cover all bases is that this show is for people who love or hate the Beatles.
That pretty much is the whole universe.
That's a lot of the others. There are people who haven't heard of them.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I want to just play one more bit of music from Pepperland and just have you talk about it, if that's okay. So this is an excerpt from the piece called Allegro. Mark, your choreography has been celebrated for being, you know, really able to strike this balance between something that's accessible to all different kinds of audiences while maintaining a real originality and commitment to the form. Is that a good way to describe Pepperland?
I want people to have a good time. I'm not afraid of my work being sort of entertaining, if you can imagine that word being said about a modern dance show. I want everybody to watch it and pretty much everybody to like it. But, you know, I can't control any of that. And if everybody in the world liked the same thing, that would be, what's that called? Disney.
Right. You're a long way from Disney, Mark Morris.
Yeah, you'd be it's pleasure is enforced by the Disney organization. So I don't do that.
Yeah. That's choreographer Mark Morris joining us from New York. Mark, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciated it.
Of course. Thank you.
And Pepperland, definitely not Disney, will be in Boston starting this weekend, running through February 10th at the Bach Center Schubert Theater, as presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston. You can get more information at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zuckoff. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.